This is Gary Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project. Today is December 12th, 1991. I'm in the Red Gym, my office in the Red Gym, with Clifford Thompson, who was the Dean of the University Law School from 1983 to 1989. Dean Thompson, if you could begin by giving us a little bit of your educational background and your early interest in law.
Please call me Cliff. If you wish to, and almost nobody calls me Clifford, but I certainly prefer either to Dean Thompson.
Okay. So.
My early background was I grew up in Kansas and went to high school there. I went as an undergraduate to Harvard on scholarship. I had a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford where I studied law, and then I completed my work at the Harvard Law School.
When did you first become interested in the study of law?
That's a hard question. I think probably at an early date, but it was never an overwhelming passion that I would do that.
Were there any professors you had, any courses you took in your early studies that had a significant impact on your later, on your thinking and on your subsequent career?
On my thinking, definitely. On my career, I can't think of anything direct. In terms of my thinking, I feel greatly indebted to, you know, quite good teachers in Kansas in grade school and high school level, and then a marvelous experience as a Harvard undergraduate. I think, you know, it was a great educational experience. It was difficult. I came there as a lot of people, I suppose, do. Not having heard of the books I was assigned and finding other students had already read those books, but it was a truly challenging and exciting sequence.
You eventually went to Africa and spent, a decade there, including a deanship. How did you get involved in that whole phase of your career?
I guess it was closer to 13 years, from 61 to 73 with a break actually at Columbia Law School. My interest in doing that, I combined a number of things. I think overwhelmingly and historically what was happening at the time I was in law school, back at Harvard 58 to 60, was that the post-war era in Africa was taking hold. You had only two independent countries sort of at the time of the end of the war, and then all of them looked to be headed for independence. So that actually 1960, which was the same year I graduated from law school, you had a extremely large number of countries become independent in Africa. And this process was taking place, or one could see it was taking place. And I got interested because I had an English law degree and I knew that in the colonial areas there were very few trained people from those countries in law, that they would be needing, they probably would be needing legal personnel in the early stages of their independence. And I mean, the facts seem to indicate that there was an opportunity for something that could actually be historically interesting, important for the countries involved, and actually in some kind of an adventure. Now, my interest, I think, in this was influenced by a number of things. When I was at Oxford, I'd had a good friend who was studying law who was a Ghanaian, but that wasn't, I think, as important as the fact that when I got back to Harvard and had those 2 years, my wife was working at MIT on a dual project, as doing research on a Russian project and an African project. And it was much more interesting in the evenings to talk about what she was doing than what I was doing. And I got really quite fascinated in what was happening in Africa. I mean, the fact that countries were becoming independent, particularly in the eastern side of Africa, with very few of their own legal personnel. It was stronger on the west side, but even there, on the west side of Africa, but even there it was difficult. And so I got it in my head after, at the beginning of my final year in law school, that I would, that it might be that this was a really interesting thing to be done. Well, at that time there was no Peace Corps, and I probably, and this is in a pre-computer age, wrote over 200 letters to various people trying to find such a job, and interviewed probably 100 people in the areas of Boston, New York, and Washington, and got a lot of a friendly response. People thought it was a very interesting thing to be done, but nobody quite knew how one would go about getting a job. And what actually happened was that after graduation, I continued the search in the summer of 60. By that time, we were headed toward an election, that of Kennedy, and eventually, I didn't know it, of course, but you'd have Peace Corps and other things starting. But in the summer of 60, I still didn't have the job, so I my wife stayed with her family in Kansas, and I headed off for West Africa with a one-way ticket and enough money for the ticket back and a bit of expense money to either find the job or not. And my father, who had not been a graduate, and my mother had not graduated from any college, and were therefore quite proud of me having gotten even a law degree, were actually tremendously supportive. They only advice I remember my father gave me was, don't end up a YMCA do-gooder. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, don't end up sweeping out the YMCA. If you're going to Africa, I mean, then that's fine, but find a job that somehow will draw on your legal talents. Well, I hadn't found a job, and to make this rather long story shorter, I on the way out, I stopped in New York at Ford Foundation to make sure a number of addresses I was going to go to in Africa were good. And secretary, a woman named Alice Maloney, came down to see me, and she insisted that I see her boss. And I said, no, I don't want to see your boss. I've already interviewed two or three people here, and all I want now is these addresses. But she insisted I come talk to him. It was a man named Francis Sutton, who was the associate director for Africa. We had a very interesting discussion, and he said, well, now, if I think of any more addresses or anything, where can I contact you? I was staying in Boston, and I was going to fly out the morning after the final Kennedy-Nixon debate. I wanted to hear that, and then I was going off to England, where I'd had some people say they were hoping to, you know, that they would like to talk to me, and maybe there were some possibilities that could be arranged in various places in Africa. And I got a call when I was there through the, I'd worked at the undergraduate newspaper, and so I gave that as a number, and I went down and had a call from this man, Sutton, who offered me a job as being his, being an associate program officer at the Ford Foundation in Africa, and insisted that I come back down and talk to him. And actually, I didn't really want to do it because, as I indicated, I was very short of cash. And he realized that this was why I was hesitating. He said, no, we'll pay for your trip back down here. And anyway, it was a great job opportunity, because the point was is that I would have an opportunity to learn more about Africa, and from that base, probably get a job that would be worth taking. And so in the end, I did take the job at Ford Foundation. And it was really through there that I got the connection to my first job in Africa, which was as the executive director of the Sudan Law Project and teaching in the University of Khartoum School. I was working as an employee of the Sudan government, but the project had connections and funding from the Ford Foundation, which was my entree. After that, all the jobs I had, I got there were quite easy in one sense to get, because once the first job had gone well, then other jobs were available because there was a tremendous need, as I'd felt there probably would be in many areas in Africa. And so actually, I was actually in that period of the 60s, early 70s, in a sense, in demand. For example, in Zambia, when they wanted to start a law school in Zambia, they hired a Ghanaian named Bensi Enchel, who had heard about me, and he sought me out to go to Zambia to help start their first national law school, which I did. That was my second job in Africa, which I did in the period of 67 to 69. So the interest in Africa rose in a complex way, and it got going with great difficulty. But once it was going, it sort of sustained itself.
And you subsequently became dean of Haile Selassie.
Yes, my last job in Africa was, I was 4 years in Ethiopia. In each of the countries, there was something very specific that needed doing. In Sudan, it was that they were trying to preserve their common law tradition, and this project had that as part of it. That is, to get the judgments by the judges in Sudan, which had not been reported, but which actually combined in a fascinating way customary law, Islamic law, statutory law, and was in fact creating a genuine common law for Sudan. And in Sudan, actually, some of the judges, many of the judges were Sudanese. They had judges who were Sudanese as early as 1939 in Sudan. The number of Sudanese lawyers and judges was small, but much larger than most countries, because Sudan had never been settled. In other words, it was colonized. There was a colonial administration, but there was not ever an aim for British expatriates to go and live there. So they were more prepared, and did, in fact, the British did an excellent job of, certainly compared to wherever else they were, in preparing legal officers. But the preservation of some kind of Sudanese common law was the project there. In Zambia, the disgraceful situation at the time of independence, which was 1964, in which there were, I think, no more than about 12 Zambian lawyers in the whole country. Actually, there were hardly any university graduates. It was the colonial educational pattern there was shocking. And so they got a university going, and then they decided that they would start a law school. And I was, as I indicated a few moments ago, was a co-founder of that university. And then the job in Ethiopia was to go through the transition period from a predominantly foreign faculty on the law school to a localized faculty. And that had been started by my predecessor, Quentin Johnstone, who was a prof at Yale, who'd been there 2 years. And when I came, there was it was a faculty of about 21, and there were three Ethiopian, and the rest were foreigners from many, many places, United States, Belgium, Germany, France, Ireland. And when I left, 4 years later, we had a majority of the faculty were Ethiopians, and the dean was an Ethiopian, the first Ethiopian dean. And that group, although some were murdered during the Mengistu regime, is still basically the same group. I had just, I guess now it's about 2 weeks ago, an invitation from the dean in Ethiopia to come visit, now that the Mengistu regime has been overthrown and so on. And it's a person that I taught as a student, a person who was my colleague when he came to be a young faculty member, and he's now the dean. So the ties some 20 years later remain remarkably strong. The school in Zambia goes very strong, and as you know, Zambia has just recently had an actual election, and they voted out Kenneth Kaunda, who looked like he wanted to be president for life, but actually there was a peaceful transition, and many of the leaders in that movement were graduates of our law school. So the law school has had an important role in Zambia. And actually, one thing has to be said, and was one of the real fascinations, was that the opportunities of training in Africa were fabulous. There's nothing like it anywhere else in the world, because unless it would be fairly independent third world countries, meaning that in the United States, your leaders come from all over the country, from all sorts of different institutions. In England, it has been concentrated for a long time on Oxford or Cambridge, but even that monopoly has been broken, although it's a bigger monopoly than you could find in the U.S., for sources of where your leadership comes from. But in the places I worked, I mean, you knew, talking to your class, you were talking to people who are going to be the first Chief Justice, first Attorney General, and all the major legal positions, quite apart from whether they might rise to senior positions, you know, in the political structure. So it was quite quite fascinating that whatever one had to offer by way of skills or character or whatever else, you certainly had an extremely important student body. It's quite exciting times. Now, what's happened in Sudan is much less encouraging. They've had political instability. The common law that we were working for is at the present time swept aside because they want to introduce Islamic law over the country. This is highly controversial because the southern Sudan are not Arab and not Muslim. And in fact, there's been a violent civil war going on for some time. So it's quite unsettled there. Many of the graduates of the law school are, of course, in positions of high importance. In fact, my colleague, who was the first Ethiopian dean, Hassan al-Tarabi, is currently more or less running the country. But the impact of the law school, the law school and the legal system, as it was known when I was there, has largely disappeared in the Sudan. So that is one, there's a contrast in all of the three places that I went.
After being there for 13 years, you decided to move back to the States, and you accepted, I believe, the deanship at the University. Well, not really. You were at SMU before Hawaii. How did that come about?
I wasn't dean at SMU. I was a professor of property law and jurisprudence. What I wanted to do when I came back from Africa, the major alternative was to go to work for a large New York law firm, actually White & Case, in their London office, which was a tempting part because I like London, I like England, or to stay in the academic world. Staying in the academic world was what I decided I wanted to do, but I thought what I want to do is to not play on my expertise. I'd like to establish credentials as an American law school teacher whose major interest is not foreign or comparative law. Now, part of that was just simply I wanted that area of expertise. Secondly, I suppose there was some fear of being marginalized, that some programs in which you, like at Columbia, when I'd helped start the African Law Center there, the difficulty is that once the soft money is gone, you may not have it continued. And I thought, if I'm going to have a long-term interest in Africa, it's better to have established myself in more traditional areas so I can avoid any difficulty that might come otherwise. And also I just wanted to become expert in American law. The trouble is I didn't have any expertise after 13 years in American law. I'd not been teaching there. And it worked out really well at SMU because they wanted a first-year property teacher. Some of the work I'd done in Africa, three volumes on Sudan land law, I'd certainly gone in depth into property and land law, if not American law. First year is not done at a deep level. And secondly, I'd done very well at Oxford in jurisprudence and continued to write and study in jurisprudence. They have always had at SMU a major jurisprudential interest, and their longtime professor, Professor Harding, had just retired. So I was really hired to do jurisprudence at SMU, and so I went there. And I feel greatly indebted to them because I'm not sure where I would have fit in easily otherwise. But after 4 years, yes, I got back into deaning. And the why thing came up and was almost, from my perspective, irresistible because, at least in my own mind, however else others would see it, was so similar to what I've been doing in Africa. The similarity was this, that you had Hawaii become, in effect, independent, that is, get statehood in 1959, and they had then had their political, you know, localization, and that was basically that the Japanese Americans who had gone off and been extraordinarily heroic in World War II, came back, had the GI Bill, became lawyers, became politically important, basically after statehood, or as I thought of it, independence, basically took over the state. And one of the things they wanted was to open the corridors of power to local people who would not have the GI Bill. And they thought one of the things you have to have is a law school. So they never had a law school. So they'd started a law school in Hawaii in 1973. And what had happened is it had gone right off the tracks. It was being threatened with closure. The first dean had been fired. Very small faculty brought in from outside. One had been, though tenured, had been in effect let go, bought out. It was an absolute chaos. So I thought here was an enterprise worth fighting for. It's the sort of thing I like. Each of the jobs I'd had in Africa were fairly, all had the capacity for something fairly dramatic to be done in a relatively short period of time if you did things right. And it seemed to me that there was a chance there for a turnaround. And in fact, we did turn around. I think probably it was the hardest job I've had to this period. I don't anticipate anything harder. It was really difficult. It worked out remarkably fast. Probably within 6 months we'd gotten stabilized. And without dwelling on that, I think one indicator is that I left there after 2 years in 1976, I guess. And the associate dean I brought in had been a colleague I'd brought to Ethiopia named Jeremy Harrison, and who'd been a great comrade in arms in Ethiopia. And I brought him to Hawaii as my associate dean, and he is now and has been for some time the dean in Hawaii.
And from there you took the next step to the University of Idaho.
Yeah, Idaho was not a big problem case. They thought they had the problem that they'd just gotten a brand new building, and it was their sort of feeling that they could become a strong regional school if they could bring in somebody to help do that. It didn't seem to me there was any kind of emergency of the sort that had occurred other places, but it was a good challenge. It was difficult. Actually, it was probably the only really difficult decision I've had in terms of opportunities, because since the Y thing had sorted out and since there was other things that could be done, it was very tempting to stay on there. And I think probably the fact that I knew Hawaii would go strong with Jeremy and for other reasons. But the big problem was schooling. I had four kids, and in Hawaii, they were all in public schools. I think people don't realize that in Hawaii, anybody of whatever racial background tends to send their kids to private school if they can afford it. The result is the public schools are badly neglected. We had four kids all in public school, two of which were extremely good schools, hardworking, and two of which were terrible, including the fact that people were murdered in school time, not in the playground afterwards. It was quite bad. And we were worrying about our kids having moved about so much anyway that to have everybody in one spot in one school for a period was very appealing. So that was the family factor was an important one in going to Idaho.
Let's stop for a second. Let's proceed now to the University of Idaho, and from there to your stay here in Muskegon.
Actually, I think we were proceeding to, I think we got over to Wisconsin.
When were you first? How did the deanship? How did your hiring here at the University of Wisconsin come about?
Sometimes you don't really know how these things happen. In this case, I do know, and in a sense, it was quite pleasing that it arose this way. By chance, in two of my deanships, there had been members of the Wisconsin faculty visiting as professors at those schools, through no contact or reason, by reason of me being there. For example, when I was dean in Hawaii, it happened that Charles Irish was a visiting faculty member, but I hadn't recruited him, hadn't even known he would be there when I came. He was a visiting tax teacher. And likewise, when I was in Idaho, Bill Foster of the Wisconsin faculty was a visitor, again, not arranged by me, but I think he was there because it allowed him to be near A, bird watching, and B, where his daughter at that time was going to school. But in both cases, I got to know those people, and both of those people were the ones who took a special interest in nominating me or getting my name forward to other members of the faculty in the selection committee and calling me to say, would I have an interest in doing it? So anyway, I was nominated, and the chair of the, I didn't know how it had come about, but that is how it happened. First I knew was that the chair of the recruitment committee, who was Margot Melly, a professor in the law school, called me and said, would I be interested? And my first response was, because I've always known, I think everybody knows about Wisconsin the way you won't know about a University of Idaho. I mean, you know about Wisconsin's national reputation, you know about its law and society tradition. So I was a bit surprised, I said, well, Professor Melly, I've always gone to some place where, generally speaking, where there was something that really obviously needed doing, and if things went right and you did things right, you could have a turnaround in a relatively short period of time. Whereas if I were asked to and accepted to come to the University of Wisconsin as dean, I can't imagine that anything needs doing other than what would take a lot of time. And secondly, why would you be asking me? In other words, I've gone where there have been short-term problems that I could do something about solving. So I'm confused as to about why you're suggesting I ought to be a candidate for your school. And she paused, there was a pause, and she said, well, you know, actually, we have a lot of problems. The truth is that Wisconsin really didn't have a lot of problems. Wisconsin had two big problems, and one was a disastrous shortage of funding, which had persisted over a very, very long period, going back for, at least 20 years. There had been that where you have a little shaved every year, and it's never really brought back. It had been for a variety of reasons, a change of a chancellor, been supportive to one who was not, and all, for whatever reason, that was a major problem. The other was the fact that, that you had within the faculty what outsiders referred to as warring camps, and in fact, the intensity of competition, in which you add the fact there were dwindling resources, created a lot of paralysis basically within the school. That there was a tremendous amount of suspicion between those who might have differing goals. So that you had warring camps is too extreme of a description, although that was the one that the ABA report, that's what they concluded. And I think that's too extreme. But the fact is that was one of the two big problems, money and the fact that you had a deeply divided faculty that was so internally suspicious of itself that there was a difficulty in getting anything at all done. And so that faculty governance, which is an extremely important thing, was really not a problem of faculty governance. It was that whatever happened, everybody wanted for sure to have a decision in it. For example, you get $2,000 that for some reason you haven't spent in the course of the year, people would insist that there be a committee set up to decide how that would be used. And they would spend 3-4 weeks and not agree on how that $2,000 should be used. And now that was the state of affairs when I came in '83.
Now, did she tell you that those were some of the problems that you'd be facing? Or are those things you learned as you went along?
I think the fact that there were inadequate resources was something that they had, it was communicated to me. I think actually at the very time they were going on the dean search, they had sort of realized that the kind of vague feeling they had that their salaries weren't very strong had been confirmed by some sort of report that committee, that the faculty had gotten hold of. And that was known. I think it was known that their salaries had dropped, the average salary or the median salary had dropped among the ABA accredited schools to 92nd, mm-hmm. and was at the bottom of the Big Ten salaries. That was known. Otherwise, just how bad the financial situation was, I'm not sure how much they realized it, except vaguely. As to the competition, I think it's one of those things that people really didn't talk about, that one had to discover that for oneself, although it didn't take long to figure it out.
Could you tell us, give us some examples of how you discovered that and find your life?
Well, apart from the fact that I simply talked to everybody individually and soon got a sense that I was being warned off of this person, that group, or other group, I suppose one of the dramatic early things that happened was a group of four extremely, I think the whole faculty was very strong, but I think four particularly strong members of faculty came to see me. And they wanted to do something with shifting resources that didn't involve them directly, but it involved someone who they wanted to give support to. I don't think it matters to get more specific than that. And after the presentation, I was sort of pressed to make a decision. I said, well, it's something I think that I need to look a lot more into to find out more about and think about before I can decide. And I was surprised at the intensity with which one of the people said, basically I was threatened. You're either with us or you're against us. I was surprised that it would come out in a group. And, I mean, although the group was a sporty group still, you're identifying the others was sort of a group threat. So I simply said, listen, if I have to decide today, I'm going to decide against you, because I can't make that kind of change without thinking about what's happening in consulting with others. So you've got your decision. If it's today, I've got to decide, you've got your decision. So they backed off that, and we got fine. And actually, I think in the long run, combined with the fact that we got a lot more resources, those people were amongst very good friends, not just at the end of my 7 years of deaning, but before that. So.
Your strengths, your skills as an administrator, your administrative style, if you will, how did that work in terms of dealing with these warring different factions? Do you think it was a good fit that you were dealing with?
I think, obviously it's immodest to say so. I do think I was a good fit for a number of reasons. One was that I kind of realized before I came, which is that they have these very diverse interests at the law school, which I could see a unity in that they didn't seem to see. And that unity was what Wisconsin pioneered in the 30s or even before, and as a premier, I think, probably the leading school in the United States in what is called law in action. And law in action is a phrase that wasn't invented here, and other schools like using it, but I think Wisconsin remains, if not the strongest, one of the very few top schools in regard to that tradition. The tradition simply is that it's the strong belief that law on the books, that is, law on the statutes, law on the case books, is extremely important, but it does not begin to reflect what actually occurs in action when people are doing things. And to limit law school teaching and law school research to what many very good schools do, namely what we call black letter law. You analyze the words of the statute, you analyze the words of the contract, you analyze the words of the judicial decision, And that's what you teach, and that's what you do research on, doesn't begin to have any real comprehension of the reality of what happens when people deal with each other, because you have to find out how it's actually, what actually occurs in action. And we had research being done in that area. We had clinics. Well, one of the big rivalries for finances was between the research division and the clinics, and yet both were, in fact, operating in the law and action field. So it wasn't like they were going after utterly different things. It's true that they wanted it for different things, but it wasn't as if one party wanted black letter law and one research and teaching, and one party wanted law and action. Everybody in the law school was very much oriented toward or sympathetic to law and action. And I think one reason I thought I was a good fit was I actually liked and appreciated everything people were doing. I mean, sometimes it happens that if you're doing one thing, you really don't have a tolerance of what other people are doing. Although I can remember it was James Bryan Conant when I think it was my first year as an undergraduate at Harvard, he was going out as president. But he said something that always stuck in my mind, which is that in a university, you've got to be tolerant of what your colleagues are doing, even though if it seems crazy, because part of why a university works is a search for knowledge, and you shouldn't assume that in advance you know what that's going to be. So you've got to be tolerant of that. Now, I was more than tolerant. I was actually enthusiastic about what people were doing. So that was easy in that sense. Now, in terms of getting them to be a more peaceable kingdom, well, that takes the help of many people. You can't do it on your own. And I think one thing I noticed right away is that first of all, you want to know what you want to get done, and then you have to decide how is it going to be possible to do that. When I was dean in Ethiopia, I had a great deal of power, and pretty much I was up front, you know, the outspoken leader, and I did confer with colleagues, but the dean there was almost like the dean was in the old days in the U.S., a great deal of power and authority, and in fact, colleagues felt very touched if you even chatted with them about these things, which is quite different coming to a situation where people think the dean shouldn't be allowed to do anything, even an example I gave you for $2,000, unless everybody has a vote following deliberations by committee. So I noticed that here there was, first of all, tremendous competition, and people wanted you to take their side in this. But the strange thing about it was that many of them did not want you to be the spokesperson for their view, because they wanted credit for it, you see. That was an interesting point, too. In other words, one of the early things that happened was that let's say there was something. Well, I can give you the example, I guess, because for a long period there had been a proposal to have an institute for legal studies, and we had a number of people supporting that, and the genius behind it was Dave Trubeck, and Dave came in and wanted my support for it, but it was clear he didn't want me espousing the idea of the institute. Was his idea. So I looked into it, and it struck me that it was a superb, what he was doing was superb, and there should be an institute. It wasn't an institute. The point was, would the faculty approve? The faculty had never got around or was unwilling to institutionalize the kind of things that he was doing with a group of some terrific faculty members. So it struck me that not only did I support it, but we had to get it enacted as an institute. And I think it was near the end of my first year where Dave came in and he said, well, he'd appreciated my support, but it was going to be yet another year in which this thing was not enacted. And I said, no, we've got one more faculty meeting. I think things are going all right. And in fact, things did go right. The faculty did approve it. And what I did was, it wasn't that difficult. What I did was found out who was really most opposed to it, and particularly those who were most opposed to it who had clout with or support by other members, and simply talked it through with them and got and got them both to understand why it was a valuable thing, and secondly, that they wouldn't feel threatened by the financial implications. Mm-hmm. Now, doing that, you're going out a little bit on the string, the way that I think Chancellor Shalala does a great deal of the time. That is, you're having to promise things you haven't got, money particularly. But you know, then you get around to getting it, and things then do work all right. But I guess it was an interesting. I guess my method was one of trying to appear most of the time not the chief lead in it. That is the facilitator rather than the person who was pushing it. Now, I think one thing I'm going to refer to, we chatted with before we started, was that a great deal of my self-serving summary of these 7 years I wrote up when I was away on sabbatical, and that appears in the University of Wisconsin Alumni Magazine. It's called the Law School Forum, called The Gargoyle, and it's the fall 1991 issue. So if anybody is actually ever listening to this interview, they should go look at that.
For the information of the person listening, this copy of that will be on file in the oral history.
Oh, good. So yeah. I think what I would say of it is that it is my honest opinion, and it's actually out there where any of my colleagues who don't agree with it can say so, but actually a number have come and said they thought I had the tone right between bragging and properly attributing everything to everyone. And I think it's a fairly, I don't think it's too sanitized. I think it's basic. If you read it, you'll see that I've either said or indicated the problems we've had in that period too. But one thing I don't go into there is about a method about how you do something, and I think a good example is one that is fairly trivial but easily provable, and that is one of the early things I did because I thought it was, you know, at a level of professionalism very, very bad. We had no policy by which faculty had to get their grading done of student exams within a limited period. So. And many law schools have this problem. They, you know, you'll have two or three teachers who, after the spring term is over, the fall is beginning, and they're still not getting their grades. And it's not professional. We ask students to meet professional standards and professional timetables. I think we have to do the same. And then there's a lot that also follows. It's extraordinarily inconvenient for students, and or even harmful if they don't have their grades by certain times. But anyway, it seemed to me it's clearly essential that a faculty have a schedule that by which they have to timely grade their exams. And I might say, of course, the law faculties do grade their own. They don't have teaching assistants to do this. This is different from many parts of the university. A law school professor does the grading of all their students, whether it's 40 students or 400 students. So it's they sort of feel we need to take the time we take. But now the reason I mention this example is that I think we within my first year did pass a policy that required people to do it, and it's had a very good success, and I'm glad about it. But I think if you asked anybody in the law school, how did that come to pass, I don't think they would connect it particularly with me. I mean, it has something that happened in my time that I definitely was supporting, but it wasn't my initiative. The truth is, it was almost entirely my initiative, meaning that and the reason it's easy to use this example is I'd done it at every other school I was. In other words, I came to Idaho, they didn't have a grading policy, I introduced one. In Hawaii, they didn't have a grading policy, I introduced one. I introduced one when I was dean in Ethiopia. I'd done this at each school. It was a clear pattern of intruding upon full freedom for profs. And in each place, I'd done it slightly differently. But what I did here was simply set up a committee which had very good faculty who were themselves extremely supportive of a grading policy, give them my support, set up on that committee students so there would be student pressure, and then politicked it in a quiet way through students so there was the student pressure for it and through the faculty. And so by the time 6 months had passed and you'd had all the discussions and so on, you probably had only two or three faculty who were still decidedly against it and voting against it. But I never would have been the one who anybody identified as being the person who initiated a new grading policy. That I supported it, yes, I was supporting a faculty initiative. And that is a way a lot of the things that we did is how I operated. Now, a lot of things occur where I had nothing to do with them. I mean, they're true faculty initiatives. But a great deal of the momentum, the truth is I really do feel that I'd say, okay, here's an area in which I think we ought to do something. I'll find out who's supportive of that, and you work it through. My basic philosophy being that Madison was the sort of place where you're not going to get away with being up front with it at a time when there's so much suspicion. And also, I was an outsider. And my idea was I'd rather be in a situation where many people rightfully claim credit for something getting done than to be like Wilson with full credit for, or large credit for the peace plan after World War I, but not getting it adopted because you didn't have enough sponsors, you didn't have enough things. So that was basically how I proceeded with it. Now, near the end, in the last 2-3 years, it was easier to do a lot of things directly, and by that time, I think certainly faculty was no longer excited about small ticket items, and we were operating on a different level of trust, I think.
Hang on. We talked about how you came into the situation here at UW and you worked more or less a consensus style of administration. Is that a consensus?
Well, a lot of the consensus was built privately and over a long period of time before you ever came out publicly and looked like you were seeking for a consensus. But thankfully, yeah, consensus is a good word as a shorthand for what I was doing.
What kind of a role did the, and maybe you could talk about it for a minute, the Academic Planning Council play in this type of stuff?
Well, every school has an Academic Planning Council of, I think, four people plus the dean, and it's mandated by the faculty legislation, I think. But most of them, it varies as to what it does in schools tremendously. I mean, in some schools it does nothing because nothing is ever asked of it except would you and your academic planning council or committee give me three suggestions who might serve on the university library committee? I mean, it would be that sort of thing, which would be a reference. But it was a group that was there in place. At the time I came, the dean would pick it and then announce the names to the faculty who had what we call consent procedure. They would then have, I think, 10 days or something in which to object if they didn't want that list, but it wasn't actually an elected group. And he tended to have a new group every year. Well, the APC actually had only one important role, I think, in period before I came, and that was it was used as part of the dean evaluation at the end of Oren's term, talking about getting a new dean.
You're speaking.
My predecessor, yeah. Oren Helston, my predecessor. But it hadn't had much of a role otherwise. Now, I thought, given that you've got such a big faculty and with these factions and so on, it might be useful to move toward some sort of delegating of responsibility in some jobs. Secondly, at a later date, when we'd gotten money for the catch-up money was to be allocated based upon overall and long-term performance. And though I'm perfectly happy to evaluate yearly performances, I wanted some faculty input into awards given based upon longer career patterns and value to the faculty. So what I did was simply, over a period of time, did a number of things to the APC. One was to have the the group have overlapping terms so that you have somebody being elected every year, and then the next year you have another person elected. So you serve a 3-year term, but you have people coming and going to give a number of, to give both continuity and new people to come on. Secondly, I changed it to having people outright elected by the nomination is from the dean and APC, but with the right of the faculty to add to those nominations. So you have an APC with greater apparent authority, greater legitimacy. And that group was, I used for, I found it extremely useful for, I guess basically the reasons I wanted to establish it. One was in terms of complicated issues on which you're trying to reach a consensus, to have a sounding board for some of the difficult aspects of a program, and to try to filter, let's say, the 100 issues people would see in regard to any one problem, and filter those down to the 3 big important things. After we'd talked about it 50 hours, we could see that the big 3 issues were, and then that made the discussion with the rest of the faculty a lot easier, as it became a filter for this sort of thing. And actually, the first problem I had in which that was useful was there was the director of our legal defense project, a clinic which we do in cooperation with the state, who'd done very good service for a very long time, then announced that he wasn't going to do it anymore. So there was a real question about whether that would collapse, whether it would be done away with, whether the money could be better spent elsewhere, whether we could get more money from the state to help support it. Really, 100 issues came up. And with the ABC, we were able to narrow that down and work with the outgoing director, work with the state, and in fact, we got a much strengthened legal defense project, which the faculty approved, and which got added, which doubled the funding from the public defender. And the ABC was very useful in that process. Now, I've had, actually, near the end, it's not that that every APC is necessarily valuable. Actually, on a very complicated issue, I worked with the APC members over the period of 6 months, attempting to persuade them to my viewpoint, and had failed to do so. And so when we went to faculty with the issue, I hadn't achieved support of that group. Actually, in the end, I'd done enough work outside of that that the faculty supported what it was I was trying to accomplish, which was in the area of what our policy should be toward of council relationships, which I talk about in the Garland.
When you arrived, you had an administrative unit in place. Associate deans, et cetera. How did you mesh with these people initially, and how did your administrative group change over the years?
Well, I think that area would be one in which I think it's the worst administrative setup I've ever seen in any of the places I've ever been. it was the worst administrative setup that I'd seen.
Also.
Well, let me tell you the good parts first. Because there were some very good parts. We had an admissions office that was understaffed and doing a job better than most admissions offices around the country. We had a duplicating room run by 2 people, which was outstanding. And you think, well, how important is a duplicating room? Well, the brief period I was at Columbia University in New York, I remember Dean Warren, who most of the time could be seen in a morning coat going out to raise money with Revlon, actually seized control of the duplicating room himself, not the associate dean, not the assistant dean, but the dean himself, because there was, quarrels going on between senior and junior faculty of whose materials were going to be duplicated in time for the exam or whatever. So it's, these areas that may seem unimportant, within the life of any particular school can be very, very important. So we had a number that were good, but otherwise, it was not hopeless. It just wasn't very good. And I would say that in the time my 7 years, we had improved it some, but not nearly to the state it should be. In other words, I don't count that as a major success. I think we did okay in that area. I mean, give you some example. For example, I had the dean didn't even have a secretary. The dean had a person sitting outside the office who was Gail Holmes, who was the budget officer, and she's a very good budget officer. But she was supposed to, her job as budget officer was constantly interrupted by also being a receptionist. But she wasn't the secretary. My stuff went out to a pool of seven secretaries, never went to the same person. So you couldn't even, you know, train one. Confidential things went out to the group of seven. It was, and then you say you want to change all this. Of course, you can't change this. There's where you're stuck with lack of money, with patterns in which various profs are going to absolutely explode if you say to one secretary, you're now going to be the dean, you can't do it. Actually, in the end, we've made a lot of changes. Gail Holmes is now has an office of her own, and she is the law school's budget officer and personnel chief. There is a secretary in the dean's office who, and so that is much better, but it's far from perfect because she's still doing a tremendous amount of typing for other faculty, so she doesn't have time to really follow up on the dean's matters. We got rid of, I suppose, and you know how hard it can be when you have basically an entrenched civil service, we got rid of probably, and with great difficulty, two or three of the secretaries who were, I thought, truly incompetent. And the ones we've gotten to replace them are much better. But that operation, there were two or three operations, and I haven't named them all, that I would have given an A to, such as the duplication and the admissions office. And the rest was sort of at a C minus, and I think we moved it up to B minus, generally through the school. What no about, better than that, though.
What about your dean staff, your associate dean staff? Jerry Payne wasn't there when you...
Well, we had Stu Gullickson was the associate dean and was good enough to stay on an extra year. He was prepared, wanted to quit immediately that Oren was no longer dean, which would have been very bad because I had no idea who might be, who could be picked as associate dean. So he did stay on, and Stu knows the state tremendously well and is just a great human being. So that was, it was an all right, it was a good transition year. I didn't feel that the associate dean had the right things being assigned to him. He didn't have enough authority and wanted to give him more and to have a few more things to be routine. And we did that. The associate dean I came up with was Jerry Thane, and Jerry was a tremendous choice. He's a person of complete integrity and discretion, and very hardworking. He just was great. He was the sort of person with whom I could discuss issues and particularly frustrations and know that they wouldn't go further than him and a person who would help contribute to the solution. And I tried to give him, did give him much more authority than it had before. And I think that movement was necessary in the school, and as Oren Helsted, my predecessor, said, he said, you know, now that you're going to be, we've started this fund raising in which he was a principal author in starting the first endowment campaign, said that, you know, if you're going to be out of the law school, you need other people doing these things. It's always a fine balance. The dean has to be in the law school enough so that it has the support of the dean's colleagues. At the same time that you're out raising money, you're not in the school where you're available to do those things. So the associate dean was a strength of the school.
I want to go back for a minute. We've mentioned your predecessor a couple of times now. How did he work in with the transition?
Tremendously. Helpful. I guess the pattern was this. I asked him a lot of things. Oren almost always said, I don't quite remember. Almost always said, I don't quite remember. But, and I think he didn't really remember, but what he then was extremely good at was discussing the general problem or principles of that issue. And so we had many, many good conversations, and he was very helpful, and I asked him when he came along on our fundraising, particularly around Wisconsin, and on these long trips, and good chats, and I'd say, well, what do you feel about this issue, that issue? But if I'd say, you know, what did you do about so-and-so's leave when they requested, he'd say, I don't remember. But, and I think he did remember, and I don't, now that I've been out a year and a half, I don't remember much either. But in terms of understanding the issue, it was quite useful. And I do owe a debt to him and consider him a good friend.
Yeah. I noticed he hasn't been interviewed, so I would like to interview him.
Crucial, yeah, it's crucial. It's crucial.
He was the only other living law school dean, was he? George Bunn was his predecessor?
No, Spence Kimball you ought to get. Spence Kimball, actually, I met for the first time. He went to the University of Chicago. Actually, crucial interview to get because here you had a first-rate dean, with tremendous academic credentials being brought in from the University of Michigan, and just, I think, becoming tremendously frustrated with the university bureaucracy and inability to convince the chancellor. I think I've met him only once. It was a great conversation at a dinner down in Chicago, and subsequent to that, he had a stroke. And but has now recovered from that. So I think it would be very useful to grab him. He was dean very, see, one of the things, Orrin was dean for 7 years, acting dean an extra year. Bunn and Kimball were only together dean 7 years. So, and I think, well, 7 years by the old scale is not long. I mean, compared to a modern scale, I think the modern deanship right now, they're very upset. They're down to 2.5 years or something. People really come into it, find it's not what they wanted, and go back to teaching and research.
I found out today in a chat with a retired Beloit professor, the first two presidents of Beloit College were there a total of 66 years as president.
Oh, yeah, that's, yeah.
Getting back to the, we talked about the APC. Were there any other structures or organizations in the law school
Well, there is a incredibly large committee structure, which the faculty was enamored of, and I think didn't realize how unimportant it was. I think they were enamored of it because of what I indicated before. There was this tremendous fight for resources. The feeling that anything that was being proposed was probably a threat to their bailiwick, and that therefore somehow the committee structure was one of the things that kept, you know, devious groups elsewhere in the school from seizing their resources. But so one of the tasks that actually I sat down with Orrin Halstead and Stuart Gullickson to do when I first came was, one of the dean's jobs is to appoint that committee structure every year. So I remember vividly that it took 2 days just for Stuart and Orrin to tell me about the committees and the structure and so on, and how important it was to get the right balance, you see, of the political interests across this extremely complicated committee structure. Because, as was absolutely true, everybody gets the list. It's a preliminary list after the dean has prepared it. And they look at it. It's like you're looking at some kind of ornamental garden. And everybody then critiques it as to whether it's got the right balance, the right people in the right place, and so on. Now, for the dean to produce such a list, it struck me as, 2 days just to hear about it. And then actually, I could see, because to get the preliminary list is at least a solid week of work, but, you know, it'd be a week of work spread over 2 weeks. So for a 2 week period, you're dominated, you know, when you've got much more important things, or so it seemed. You're figuring, because you have to call people, would you be willing to serve? Are they going to be here? They got a special, so many, many phone calls. Now, the truth is that I don't think most of the committees did much. I mean, one of the things I did at the end of the first year was I had every committee chair report on what their committee had actually accomplished. And you found I had spent more time establishing the committee than most committees had ever spent on doing anything, right? So, I mean, I talked about this in a, you know, in a good-humored way about people. Do we really? And so I cut down the size of some committees. And I just, you know, I spent a lot less time on establishing the committees. Or when I got it established and got the pattern that one everybody liked, I just said, well, not we weren't able to do all that much last year. Let's just keep the same committee for next year. Now, I will say right away that the ad hoc committees are usually where the action was. For example, when I was trying to get a grading policy, I set up an ad hoc committee, one-year-only committee. And that committee did a lot of work to get it through. Or the permanent committees, the one that is absolutely essential, which was extremely good faculty committee, extremely important faculty committee, is the faculty recruitment committee. I think of many things that faculties do right up there amongst the top that they must have a role on in terms of faculty governance is choosing their new colleagues. And that was extremely well done. And the other is the tenure committee. That is, of those people you've chosen, have they done enough to justify giving them the vote of confidence that tenure entails? And those two committees were important committees and did excellent jobs. The rest, if you looked at the list, they take up about 3 or 4 pages. You have all sorts of oddly named committees, Equity Action Committee, and so on. And many had never met. Many had never done much. Or they do meet, or worse, actually, the worst pattern was where you have committees that meet all year long. And at the end of the year, they've not done anything. Now, I mean, a certain amount of communication is, in fact, extremely important. But that structure was there.
So did that change? Are there fewer committees now, or are they...
I think, yeah, well, I think the total number of committees is not significantly smaller. The size of some crucial committees, such as the curriculum committee, are significantly smaller. And also what I did was, for example, on the recruitment committee, made it possible for the chair to hold over for more than 1 year. I mean, part of our problem was in something like recruitment, you've got to have some continuity, and we had insufficient continuity. But that faculty committees, the structure was much less important than whatever committee you set up on a ad hoc basis to take care of whatever problem you had, plus the change role of the APC, and plus the fact that I never sat in the office just waiting for people to show up. I went out and chatted to those people over a period of time with everybody, but in a short period of time with those people I knew to be critical to my understanding of a particular issue and to working through an agreement on something that might be quite difficult.
Now, besides your responsibilities with the law school, you also are a citizen of the university. There is a dean's council, which encompasses all the deans, and they meet, what, every other week, I believe it is?
Yes.
Could you talk about that for a minute? What do you see as their primary function? Do you see them as being meaningful?
I think this is a very good question insofar as the contrast with some institutions and the way they're used differently is interesting to me. For example, in Idaho, there was very strong governance involving the faculty by way of the Dean's Council, because you had, when I was there, a president who delegated a great deal and was very successful, you know, out raising money. So the vice president chaired the Dean's Council. The Dean's Council, he really involved them in extremely important university decisions, including major budgetary directions. And the deans, in turn, involved their faculties in these issues, because this particular vice president would raise issues sufficiently in advance. You really had a governance process. Now, in Wisconsin, the deans really, in a sense, aren't in the governance loop. The Dean's Council, we have a faculty senate. I've often thought here that in certain ways, the faculty senate is very important. In other ways, they don't have a clue as to what's happening with basic chunks of money or any voice in those bases. I mean, it's in a sense, oddly enough, Idaho, which didn't have as strong a faculty senate, had a much stronger input into fairly basic things.
Wisconsin has always prided itself.
I know, it's, and I'm not an expert on how Wisconsin system really works, and I know there's a lot of give and take that makes things work differently than, you know, there was law in action, and, I actually was president of the faculty senate at SMU, and in that position sat on the board of governors, which I don't think, or whatever it's called, board of regents, which I don't think occurs here. We don't have a, the faculty president doesn't sit as an ex officio post. So you have different ways that, that you get faculty input and how much you really give them to do. I mean, for example, and I'll come back to the Dean's Council, but I think any dean ought to be able to figure out that you can give faculty a false sense of faculty governance by giving them silly things to dispute every month. You know, you can, I mean, it's very easy to give them issues that will excite them. I mean, actually, the grading policy could be in that exam. I don't consider that extremely important, but not at the heart of the law school in terms of where major chunks of money are going to go and so on. I mean, that's really where faculty.
Almost like misdirection.
Yeah, misdirection, that's right. But in the University of Wisconsin, when I came, the Dean's Council, which met every 2 weeks, was Irv Shainstyle as chancellor. He was very well organized. He had a very well worked plan of what he was going to do with the university. I don't think I've ever had a boss who was better at mastering both the big picture and details as Shane was. He was extremely good at that. And he and his staff had more or less worked out where they were going. And the function of the Dean's Council, by and large, was to tell us what was going on. And I actually took notes and therefore and paid attention to what was going on. So you could see when things, themes got repeated, which was, you know, because then I know it was what's in the mind of the chancellor, which is, you know, which is useful in making my arguments to the chancellor. And I found that actually quite useful. I mean, it wasn't a waste of time. He covered in a confidential and in a clear and direct way major issues in the university and what they were intending to do about it. And there was an opportunity for opinions and speech and so on, and occasionally actually something put up for our approval, but usually not, in my memory, anything of any great significance.
So it was an
informational type. It was overwhelmingly an informational function. Now, when Bernie Cohen was the acting chancellor, I think perhaps because people had said to him or because in his own mind he felt it might be nice to have more discussion of the deans of substantive issues, was a goal that I think he had. My impression was it, and he had too short a time, so it's not a judgment about what he would have done in a longer time. In a short period of time, it was not done. Mainly what happened, you got into conversations that didn't have an end and didn't decide anything, and which had the disadvantage, I think, for most of our viewpoint, is that it went over the time that where we knew with Shane and when Bernie Cohen was his associate, to answer, when we knew we'd be getting out of there. We knew, I think, I can't remember now, but I think it was 1:30 to 3, precisely. It never went later than 3, and it started promptly at 1:30. And I remember when Bernie was doing it, he was trying to get discussions, but, you know, it's 3:15, 3:20, and nothing's happening and nothing's going to happen. The Chancellor Shalala, and I have only, I guess what, I had about a year and a half, 2 years maybe experience with her. Well, very unpredictable is basically part of it. In one side, from my view, it was worse, meaning there were a lot of times in which she might even be there, where it was a show and tell. The librarian get up and tell about the new technology they want to put in the library, and which, yeah, in a sense, was interesting. On the other hand, it could be more important and more decisive in terms of something happening, because occasionally an issue would arise and it was actually up for grabs. And you could tell that the chancellor was going to decide something during the course of that sequence. And in fact, there might be a decisive moment in which one would be participating. And you could actually see sometimes her staff looking, you know, a little discombobbled, because this was suddenly coming up for a decision. Now, I think Dave Ward and part of Donna's plan is to have a real provost, and I think he has now been officially named a provost, that isn't true. You know, wants to be in more in control of these things. And while he had begun to exercise this role when I was still dean, in fact, I was on the committee that helped pick him. And so it was being transformed, and I can't speak to what it was because I didn't see enough of it. What I saw in the Dean's Council was, in contrast with Donna Chalala and Herb Shane, was the council did reflect their personalities in a way. I mean, the strength of, and I've said already the strengths of Irv Shane's meetings, the strength of Donna's is the political momentum that she can get going on things, and the fact that she is in fact a very good politician. I mean, she's doing a whole array of things that Irv did not do. I mean, she's in the political arena. She's really there's a lot of action, but in the sort of in the area of sort of clear staff planning, it wasn't the same. So there, I thought at one point, if you could have had them as a team, it'd be the best combination. Always. They're both persons of tremendous strength. Is my impression.
What about other? Were there any other campus-wide organizations or committees that you were that deans were involved in?
None that I think I could add much to. I was on. I did things that I thought were useful university. I participated in what I thought were useful university functions, and even contributed, like a round table, which you know is this thing, the club that's met. Not a club anybody can be in and wants to, but they meets twice a week, and you have people, staff and faculty combined, and you have somebody from the staff or faculty speak about their area of expertise, and you have maybe 250 to 500 people. And
twice a month, you said twice a week.
I meant twice every other Tuesday, yeah. And I co-chaired that one semester because it's not because it was an honor, they were looking for a coach. And I served on a number of a lot of committees, and I can't say that they're any different than any other university I was in, and a number of search committees. I guess one, just by the way, observation of the sort that could be interpreted many ways, I suppose, and I'll just give the facts, is that I think we came up on the vice chancellor, or now called the provost. I think we came up with a very good person. I was very happy to see David Ward picked. So this comment has nothing to do with our ultimate, our ultimate choice. But in that process, there were a number of nominations, and there was sort of a preliminary vetting, checking of those in early January, where we were going to cut it down to about 20. And then from the 20, the committee would meet, and I guess, then get serious about a short list. Well, it happened that I, because of the alumni trips, we used the period between terms to go to visit alumni in New York and Washington and wherever the American Association of Law School meetings is being held. And so I wasn't able to attend the two or three meetings that year in the early January, and I thought it would make no difference because I would be back for the list of 20. But the interesting thing about that was that one of the people who'd been nominated, by a number of people actually, was Professor Walter Dickey of the law school. Now, Walter Dickey had actually served a major state role. He'd been appointed by Governor Earle as the head of the prison and probation system for the entire state of Wisconsin. And he'd had a four-year term, which had been, I think, by both parties, said to be extremely professional. So here's a person who's actually run a major division of the Wisconsin government, knows Wisconsin politics very well, has very good academic credentials, has terrific service record. And I was startled to find that when I got back, he hadn't made the list of 20. So I talked to a number of people on the committee, but in particular the chair, and I said, not that he should be picked. I see a lot of good people. But I'm baffled how somebody with this background could not be picked. He said, because he's not had university experience. I mean, he should have been an assistant vice chancellor. Now, I was so staggered, frankly, personally by this. I mean, anybody can be an assistant vice chancellor, honestly. Anybody can be it. I mean, there's not that much to a job. It's hard to fail as an assistant vice chancellor. And it's just not experience of a major administrative sort. But that's sort of in the sequence. I mean, that somehow I won't elaborate on it. I just thought it was interesting. I don't want to try and explain why a committee of university people, even where the person they're talking about is a university person, don't see any connection between administrative experience and a job outside of the university. I think it's an extreme example of my own.
One final question on the structure part. Did you ever deal with the regents?
Yes, but this, again, I find an interesting question, because the manner in which the dean deals with the regents is very much, if the dean has any sense, is very much dictated by the views of the dean's boss, whether that be a chancellor or president or whoever that is. Because many chancellors or presidents don't want the dean dealing directly with the regents. They don't want that. I mean, you know, they want you to meet them at functions, and if they ask you to see them, fine, but they don't want you making independent pleas for. And in fact, if you do that, you get your neck cut. In other words, I've seen a lot of deans get their, in fact, in the end, harm their faculties by attempting to help their faculties by doing an end run around the chancellor directly to sympathetic members of the Board of Regents. So you have to be, the dean has to be very sensitive about that, because you do want to get to the regents if this matters. So the pattern there was that Chancellor Shane, on the whole, preferred us not to have that kind of substantive contact. Whereas Donna Shalala didn't mind. I mean, she herself is such a politician. She'd prefer to know what you're doing. But it's not like there'd be any, you know, if you want to see X or Y on the bar, fine. She'd prefer to know, so she, you know, it gives a sense. But I think Shane's pattern is in the universities I've been in, the more common one, by the way. I think Donna's particularly at ease, confident about her own, even when she's having quarrels with the region, she doesn't worry about this. Now, why it's an interesting question, I think, is that I think it's difficult for a dean when you're not supposed to be talking to the regents, and where there's a number of lawyers on the regents, almost inevitably those lawyers on the regents think you're neglecting them. They think you ought to be coming to them. Now, in fact, we got a couple of times rockets out of one or other lawyer regents, and I got permission to deal with those rockets, you see. But I sort of always felt it'd been much better if I'd just been having, you know, continuing relations with them. Yeah, if you're only going to the regents when you've got a problem or when they're perceiving a problem, you look like you're ignoring them. And I don't know, but I speculated that when Bob Stein over at Minnesota, who remains there, the dean of the Minnesota Law School, was a candidate for the president at Minnesota. He didn't get it, and it was publicly in the papers that it was a very close vote, I think like 5-4 or 7-6 or something, that the lawyer regents voted against him. And it occurred to me that one of the reasons might well have been the problem I'm just discussing, that as dean, he wasn't able to communicate with him to the degree he really probably would have liked to. And then when some crucial issue comes up, suddenly they say, where have you been? Now you're around. It is a difficult thing. And in fact, in the last 2 years, of course, I was trying to see some of those regions better, but it's kind of late by that time. It's kind of late at that time.